All right, good morning, everybody. We're going to call this meeting to order. I see our testifiers are here today, so if they want to approach the dais, they can get their materials ready. I'm State Representative Andrew Carlson, just the vice chair for the committee. But before we get going, Helen Roberts has a few opening comments to make.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make a comment on the four boards that we're going to hear from today. They are all occupational licensing boards, which so the boards all collect various licensing fees and examination fees. These fees are deposited in the general fund and are known as non-dedicated receipts, and then the boards are funded directly through a general fund appropriation that is made in the state government finance bill.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. With that, if our testifiers could introduce themselves. Andrew Baker. Andrew Baker is going to make the introductions.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Andrea Barker. I am the Assistant Executive Director for the Board of Accountancy. Doreen Johnson is our Executive Director, but she is out on medical leave, so I am filling in for her this morning. I have Sharon Jensen with me. She is a CPA and the Vice Chair of our board. And then I also have Chaz McElroy, and he is also a CPA, a member of the board, and a member of our legislative team.
Well, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
And if you want to begin with your testimony or presentation.
Okay. So with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to first, before I go into the Board of Accountancy's presentation, explain how the two boards work together. I'll also be testifying for the Board of Architecture and Engineering. So it's a little bit unusual how we are set up, so I wanted to explain that first. So the two boards are completely separate, standalone boards. We have two separate budgets, two completely separate boards. One board has 9 members, one has 21. Around 2006, the executive director for the Board of Accountancy retired, and through an agreement between both boards, we combined on an administrative level, which means that we share resources on the back end as a cost-saving measure. So we share an executive director, we share an assistant executive director, we share office space, equipment like the copy machine and the computer network, so the boards split those costs rather than each having their own office space and their own copy machine. And then we have interagency agreements between staff of both boards so that we can share share duties and ensure that we have separation of duties and collaborate on projects and fill in for each other during busy times. So it really works well. So I just wanted to briefly explain how those two boards work together, because we are two separate boards and I'll be doing two separate presentations. The Board of Accountancy was created in 1909 to regulate the practice of public accounting. All of the examination and licensing boards are granted certain authorities under Chapter 214. The board also has specific authorities provided in Chapter 326A, which include determining the education, examination, experience, and continuing education requirements for licensure, adopting professional standards and the rules of professional conduct, enforcing laws and rules related to the practice of public accounting. And our mission is public protection, of course. We accomplish this by ensuring that individuals entering the profession meet standards of competency and they maintain their licenses in good standing. The standards for licensure across the nation are substantially equivalent, allowing for true mobility of CPAs. An individual licensed in one state can easily practice in another state, often without having to get a license or submit an application for that other state. And then after initial licensure, individuals are required to complete 120 hours of continuing education on a rolling three-year cycle, including 8 hours in regulatory or behavioral ethics. Additionally, in addition to individuals, we regulate CPA firms to assure the public that the services provided by the firm are, in fact, provided by certified public accountants. In order to conduct audits, firms must have a firm permit. The board ensures that members of the firm are properly licensed, that the firm is fulfilling its responsibility in supervising its CPAs, that the firm remains up to date in following the laws of Minnesota, including requirements for peer review for those firms that are completing audits. We currently license just over 10,000 CPAs with an active status, and we have another 5,600 with an inactive status, and nearly 1,500 firms and sole proprietorships with CPA firm permits. One of the main components of our mission is enforcing the statutes and rules and standards governing the practice of public accounting in a fair, expeditious, and consistent manner. We accomplish this through education and communication with stakeholders, legislative and rule updates, and through the complaint and disciplinary action process. Enforcement actions that we take are public information and are reported on our website and in our newsletter. We report these actions also to the national database, where all states can easily access the actions of other jurisdictions. Discipline may include revocation, suspension, or conditions put on the license, including additional continuing education. The board also may assess up to $5,000 civil penalty per violation. During the last biennium, the board issued 104 public orders, not including automatic revocations for failure to renew. In one case, an individual whose CPA certificate and firm permit were expired performed an audit of financial statements for the City of Holloway, an audit of financial statements for the City of Murdoch, and an ERISA audit for a Minnesota-based company. The board found that she offered and performed various attest services without a valid CPA certificate and a CPA firm permit, as required by law. The board issued a cease and desist order and assessed a civil penalty of $7,500. In another case, a Minnesota CPA pled guilty in Minnesota federal court to a felony for filing a false tax return. He was sentenced to 4 years probation and ordered to pay restitution to the IRS in the amount of $420,446. The CPA's attorney notified the board of the guilty plea as required by board rules, and a hearing before an administrative law judge ensued. The judge issued findings of fact, conclusions of law, and recommendations to the board. The facts included the following. The respondent was the sole proprietor for two restaurants in Big Lake and St. Michael. Law enforcement received information regarding the respondent and his restaurant businesses from a confidential source who reported that respondent did not deposit proceeds of cash sales from either restaurant location into business bank accounts. Instead, he routed proceeds into his personal account through electronic transfers. He deposited large sums of cash into his personal bank account, transferred over $400,000 from the restaurant business accounts into his personal checking account, purchased a $60,000 Land Rover, and used his personal checking account to pay creditors and to make routine payments for utilities, insurance, and mortgage. He regularly wired cash to China in amounts of $4,000 to $6,000. The IRS executed search warrants on his home and businesses and seized handwritten ledgers documenting over $1.5 million in cash received by the restaurants over 4 years. He failed to report nearly $1.3 million of those receipts, resulting in the federal tax obligation of $420,000. He did not report any wages received by him or his wife from either restaurant location on either of their individual tax returns for those 4 years. And during the last year, the returns were filed. It was after he had become a CPA, and he prepared and signed his and his wife's returns as a CPA. So the conclusions of law included statements that filing false tax returns and pleading guilty to a felony of filing false tax returns constitute fiscal dishonesty prohibited by the board's rules, and that the board taking disciplinary action against the licensee would be in the public interest. In a memorandum attached to the report, the judge succinctly summed up the board's enforcement duties. He stated that the board must protect the public from dishonest, disreputable, or incompetent practitioners, and that when fulfilling this mandate, the board must consider not only the respondent's acts, but also the harm to the public if such acts remain unpunished and the deterrent effect upon others of a severe penalty. So the licensee was censured and reprimanded, and his CPA certificate and practice privileges were suspended for 8 years. Those are just a couple of examples of the enforcement action that the board has taken in the last couple of years to ensure the protection of the public. The board itself has 9 volunteer board members appointed by the governor to 4-year terms. 7 members are CPAs from a combination of large and small firms, and 2 are public members. The board and its committees meet 8 times per year, with the exception of the complaint committee, which meets more often. Members evaluate the credentials of applicants for licensure certification to ensure that the education, examination, and experience requirements have been completed. They also evaluate applications for firm permits, consider requests for waiver of rules, review firm permit peer review reports, and conduct random continuing education audits. Additionally, the board discusses information pertinent to the profession on a national level and continually reviews its statutes and rules and proposes changes as needed. Finally, the board is a voting member and active participant in the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy, an organization made up of member boards from each of the 55 licensing jurisdictions. NASBA, in conjunction with the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, develops, administers, and scores the national CPA exam required for licensure in the United States. NASBA also promotes uniformity of CPA licensure laws to allow for mobility of licensees across state lines. During the last biennium, board members spent 2,100 hours on board activities. The board operates with an executive director and an assistant executive director, both of whom are shared 50% with the Board of Architecture and Engineering. In addition, the board has 5 staff, including an investigator. During the last biennium, staff received and prepared for board review approximately 1,300 applications for CPA certification and 215 applications for firm permit, renewed approximately 18,000 licenses and firm permits each year, fulfilled 340 verifications of examination results, license history, and disciplinary actions, gathered facts for 167 new complaints, received and prepared for board review documentation for over 200 continuing education audits, and supported the board in all its initiatives. The board collects application, licensure, certification, renewal, and late fees, which are set by the legislature to cover the board's direct and indirect costs. These fees, along with fines and civil penalties, are deposited into the general fund. The legislature appropriates funds to the board from the general fund for the board to conduct its business. The board receives no pass-through funding or revenue from any other source. At the end of the biennium, unused funds are returned to the general fund. Expenditures include administration, information technology, enforcement, outreach and education, and credentialing activities. Staff salaries and benefits comprise 68% of the board's budget. The board's base level budget has remained relatively flat over the years, while its revenue has steadily increased. In the last biennium, the board's revenue was nearly triple the amount it was appropriated. While we realize today is not the time to make our case for additional funding, we do want to let you know that we requested a budget increase of approximately $90,000 for the next biennium to cover increased operating costs, additional enforcement activities, rulemaking, and IT projects. We look forward to providing details about these expenses at a future meeting. Now I'm going to turn the mic over to Sharon Jensen.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting us to present the functions of the Board of Accountancy. The board's role in licensure and enforcement is an extremely important activity that protects the public. The individuals and business community from governments, from federal to local levels, rely on professional accounting services. The public hires CPAs because they know they've met a rigorous requirement for licensure, and that indicates to them a level of competency. The public recognizes that CPAs possess expertise in many disciplines, and such as financial reporting, advisory services, tax, etc. And the CPA is recognized as a trusted professional in the by clients in the business community of all sizes. The Minnesota Board of Accountancy, as well as the state boards in all 55 jurisdictions, provide oversight to uphold and support the interest and ensure public protection and consistent application of state statutes and rules. Through this oversight, the State Board ensures that the professional services are provided to the public using high-quality national practice standards, and that all licensees adhere to a national and professional code of conduct. The Uniform Accountancy Act, the UAA, is the model law that regulates accountancy, and it's adopted across the 55 jurisdictions in the United States. It requires licensure in the state of an individual principal place of business. The UAA allows for interstate practice mobility, and only if the state's licensure requirements are substantially equivalent to the other 55 jurisdictions. The UAA requires that state boards must be able to serve actions against other state licensees through their state boards. The UAA establishes competency requirements for licensees that are adopted in the 55 jurisdictions and enforced by state boards of accountancy across the country to protect the public. A few examples of these requirements are that state boards are charged with oversight and enforcement would be the uniform accountancy exam that Andrea mentioned earlier, experience requirements that are consistent across state jurisdictions, and that they are applied, the domestic standards that are applied to domestic applications are also applied to our international candidates that are seeking a CPA certificate in the United States. The board establishes continuing education policy and standards that are uniform with the other 55 jurisdictions, and it enforces continuing professional education programs so that we can assure that the competency of CPAs is maintained. The board requires peer review process. This allows us to ensure that accounting services were delivered under consistent professional standards and that they were applied in the appropriate manner for the engagement. State boards, as Andrea has mentioned, are assisted by the National Association of State Boards. That organization is made up of members from all 55 jurisdictions. Their board of directors are made up of members from different state boards across the country. I serve on that board as a director at large, and their mission is to support initiatives and enhancements for state boards across the country. They also help us with the exam. They do a lot of review on the model rules that we operate under the UAA to make sure that it's meeting the latest or reflecting the latest environment that CPAs are operating in. CPAs provide an intricate role in stewardship of funds and financial information and business community advice. The accountancy regulation and the Minnesota Board of Accountancy represent one of the most pro-competitive and efficient regulatory models in the nation when it comes to reducing trade barriers and ensuring that the public protection is there at every turn. We review the statutes and rules frequently, and I'm going to turn it over now to my colleague, Chaz McElroy. We'll give you some highlights of some of the changes that we're proposing for this year.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. If you could pause just for a second so we can officially call this meeting to order by approving our minutes from last time, and then we'll get to Mr. McElroy's comments, so we'll get things going officially here. It looks like we have a quorum, so we can call. Let's see. Representative Quam, do you have a chance to review our minutes from last meeting?
I have, and I would so move.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Minutes are approved. And then Let's see, where do I go to next? We can just return back to our presiders. Thank you for that. Mr. McElroy, if you can continue with your presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'll talk briefly about a few of the statute changes. One statute change we're looking for is retroactive enforcement. As Andrea mentioned, occasionally but not very often, a CPA commits a crime. When that happens, the Board of Accountancy lets the legal process play out, which can take quite a while. The CPA can let their license expire during that legal process period of time, and then the board loses their authority to deal with the licensee. So what we're asking for is 2 years after expiration of the license to let the board finish off their process. Other states have it, and it's a practical change in our statutes. We're looking for a status of retired status. Right now, when a CPA retires, they can call themselves CPA inactive, and annually they need to register with the board, pay a fee to maintain that status. And though it may be the only thing they have to do as a CPA all year, they forget to do that and in their retirement. And it becomes inefficient for the board and for the CPA, and it's kind of a frustrating process. CPA retired status, the CPA could call themselves CPA retired at age 55 and older and not have any other obligations with the board if they're not practicing. We'd like to eliminate a $40 CPA exam fee. Previously, the Board of Accountancy in Minnesota processed the CPA exam for applicants in Minnesota. That's been taken over by the National Association of State Board of Accountancy. That $40 fee is still being paid, even though the board doesn't do anything. And so it's really just right and fair to eliminate that fee from the statute. I'd like to clarify the definition of a test. A test is a technical term in the auditing literature, in the body of literature for CPAs. It means assurance, like an audit. That definition in Minnesota is missing the governmental auditing standards, which is a big and important body of literature, so it's more of a housekeeping item to upgrade the definition of a test. I'd like to change the means by which disciplinary orders are delivered. In statute, it's now required by certified mail, which costs $8 every time. It's a very inefficient process that's happening at the Board of Accountancy. An example is somebody graduates from a college in Minnesota, say the University of Minnesota, becomes a CPA in Minnesota, and then moves out of state. They don't notify the board. The Board of Accountancy spends time tracking them down to see where their license is at. And by getting rid of the certified mail, it often comes back undeliverable. The address is changed from the apartment or wherever they live. And it's no longer practical. So, and we'd like to, those are the statute changes, just inform you. An initiative the board will be taking this year is to have a strategic planning process. It happens every 3 years. It's going to happen in April. A representative from the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy will be the facilitator. They facilitate it for other states, and it's a very productive process for the staff and the board to go through every 3 years. So we'll be doing that in April of this year. That concludes our presentation, Mr. Chair, and we appreciate the time this morning.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to circle back real quick to the motion to approve the minutes. We had a motion by Representative Quam. So with that, we need to take a vote on the minutes. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Minutes approved. Or those opposed? Minutes approved. Okay. With that, we have some questions. Representative Quam, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And referencing page 13 on your annual report, I'm just curious, on the exam statistics, is there any corollaries as to why approximately 90% of those not defined binary gender-wise failing? Mr. Chair,
yes.
If you look on page 13 of your biennial report that was handed out to us, on the bottom right column, and you look under Minnesota, female, male, and NA with an asterisk, approximately 90% failed. Is there any corollaries to that, or is that a statistical anomaly?
Representative Quam, this is Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The actual percentage is less than 1%. It's 0.4%. It's 19 people.
Mr. Chair, If you look at the pass-fail, four passed, 34 failed. That's approximately a 10% pass and 90% fail. I'm rounding up.
Oh, I see.
Right. And so I'm wondering, because of that group that is non-binary defined, is there any corollary or cause to why that might be an anomaly, since all the other, you know, areas, it's much closer to 50-50 or 60-40.
Ms. Parker?
I don't have the answer to that. That category isn't that they're necessarily non-binary. It's that they haven't selected a gender, so we don't know what it is.
Right. That was kind of what I was interpreting, too. They just chose not to identify.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, did you have your own information technology staff?
Ms. Parker.
Mr. Chair, no, we do not have our own information technology staff. We contract through, well, it's not contract. It's Minute Services provides it, but it's through also the Department of Commerce. So the Department of Commerce IT staff, who are Minute employees, are the ones that handle our IT work for us. And then we also have a programmer, a contractor that writes our database.
Further question? Representative Vogel, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure to which testifier, but as you know, last year before, we had a little bit of a dust-up between the Office of State Auditor and the counties and so forth. So the question is, if I'm a CPA and I go in as a CPA firm and audit a county, it would come under your jurisdiction?
That's correct. And we have been working very closely with the State Auditor's Department on municipalities and government auditing. They have done their review. Issues that they have found in those, they've sent over to us. So there has been a very close relationship developed over the last year with the State Auditor's Department, which we intend to continue with the new State Auditor. But we do work closely together, but they would fall under our jurisdiction, and they also are under the jurisdiction of the State Auditor because they review all governmental audits that come through.
Mr. Chair, so the follow-up is that if you go in and you're a CPA, you're going to be held to the standards of the Board of Accountancy. If you happen to work for the State Auditor, would you still have to be a CPA? And if you were a CPA, would you be held to those standards? Or are you held to the accountability of the State Auditor?
Ms. Jensen.
Let me clarify to make sure I understand your question. If they are CPA, they would be held to the standards of the Board of Accountancy. And are you asking, are the auditors that are with the State Audit Department also CPAs?
Well, yeah, that's part of the question is, would you have to be a CPA to go in and do a county audit if you work for the State Auditor? And if you were a CPA, if that's not the case that you have to be a CPA, you can just work for the State Auditor and go in and do the audit, there's a difference there. Some of them may be CPAs, some may not. If they are a CPA, do they come under your jurisdiction? But if they're not a CPA doing the same work, then they don't come under your jurisdiction.
Ms. Jensen.
Thank you for clarification. It is my understanding that the auditors that are with the State Audit Department are CPAs. The ones that we have a relationship with and have worked closely with over the last year are all CPAs, and they are under our jurisdiction also.
Representative Vogel?
One further follow-up. So, you know, my concern is I was highly dismayed because of the public perception of the CPA community not doing good audits, and then also the cost to these counties that had differences because they thought they were doing the right thing. So then when the report came out, of course, it said that the auditor's office was not following basically the principles of accounting by having the reviews, the management meetings, or whatever. So that's where I was looking for, how would the board, or maybe the board can't get involved in something like that, because I do appreciate the new state auditor coming in the other day and saying how they want to work together, but what you want to do is be able to reduce or negate anything like that ever happening again, because it's really a blemish on us as a state. So the question is I'm gathering that there's, if you go in and do a county audit as a CPA, you're under the board. If the state auditor goes in, though, that's not under the board, and therefore maybe there might have to be some tie, or is it impossible because of statutory issues to have some tie, so that we have a consistency here of who's watching the hen house.
Ms. Jensen, did you want to respond, or Ms. Parker?
I'll try. Chaz, you can step in here, too. We do have a disconnect there. I think that probably both entities would be auditing to the same standards professionally that are developed on a national basis, but the board does not have a jurisdiction over the state auditor's department. Chaz, do you want to add anything?
No, I think you've got it. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Further questions? Further questions for the testifiers? Well, thank you so much for being here on this cold Thursday morning. We appreciate your time, and we'll look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you.
And at this time, I'm going to turn this back over to our chair, Mr. Nelson, Representative Nelson.
Just start your testimony. While we're switching here, Our next up is the Architectural Engineering Land Surveying and Land Architectural Board.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm still Andrea Barker. I'm still the Assistant Executive Director now for the Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. Unfortunately, we don't have a nice short acronym. And I am here this morning with Nirmal Jain. He is our board chair, and he is a professional engineer.
Welcome to the committee.
Oh, thank you.
So the Board of Architecture and Engineering, for short, was created in 1921 originally to regulate the practice of architecture, professional engineering, and land surveying. In 1976, the practice of landscape architecture was added to the board's jurisdiction. In 1992, the Title Act for Certified Interior Design was added. And then finally, in 1995, the practice of geology and soil science, or geoscience as it's called, was added. Again, the board's specific statutory authority are provided in sections 326.02 to 326.15 and include determining the education, examination, and experience requirements for initial licensure and the continuing education requirements for continued licensure. We also enforce the laws and rules governing the practice of the professions. Chapter 214 also provides the certain authorities to all of the exam and licensing boards. Our mission, of course, is public protection. And licensure and certification is essential to public protection because it requires individuals to meet the standards of competency before practicing. But what exactly are some of the things that licensees and certificate holders and under this board do that affect us all? It would take all day to delineate everything that these professionals do, but I'll try to give you a few examples. Architects design buildings and ensure that they meet codes and standards so that they are safe to occupy. Professional engineers design mechanical and electrical systems within those buildings and make sure that the thousands of gallons of water running through the pipes stays overhead. Land surveyors establish property boundaries. Land is a finite resource, and it is important that proper boundaries are determined before construction occurs. Landscape architects design outdoor spaces such as parks, golf courses, the playgrounds at our children's schools, and even nature preserves. professional geologists determine the geological conditions affecting a structure, because you can't build a bridge on ground that can't support it. They also calculate whether an aquifer will have enough water for its intended use and provide solutions for fixing contaminated water supplies. Professional soil scientists determine proper design and proper locations for underground septic systems, such as those at your cabin. Without proper design and placement, you can end up with overflow and groundwater and soil contamination. Certified interior designers working in nursing homes, hospitals, and office buildings have improved the well-being of inhabitants by designing spaces with proper lighting, seating, workspace, and non-load-bearing wall layouts. We currently have approximately 20,000 licensees and certificate holders, with professional engineers and architects holding the greatest share of the total. Some of these individuals hold multiple licenses in two or more professions, such as architecture and certified interior design, or professional engineering and land surveying. We accomplish our mission of public protection by ensuring that individuals meet the education, examination, and experience requirements for licensure, certification, and maintain their licenses and certificates in good standing. Licenses or certificates for all professions under the board's jurisdiction require at least a bachelor's degree, including coursework specific to the profession in which licensure is sought, passing national examinations, and between 3 and 5 years of professional experience. After initial licensure, individuals are required to complete 24 professional development hours every 2 years, including 2 hours dedicated to ethics, in order to renew their licenses. We also investigate complaints and take disciplinary action against those who violate the statutes and rules. Again, discipline may include revocation, suspension, or conditions put on the license, including additional continuing education requirements. Individuals may also be assessed civil penalties of up to $10,000 per violation. Enforcement actions are public information and are reported on our website and in our newsletter. We also report these actions to the national databases, where all states can easily access the actions of other jurisdictions. And we do check those databases for individuals that are licensed in Minnesota to see if they've had disciplinary action taken against them in another state. During the last biennium, the board issued 28 public orders. In one case, an individual who had never been licensed by the Minnesota board held himself out as a professional engineer by signing with the initials PE after his name on 4 geotechnical investigation reports in Zumbrota, Webster, New Germany, and Waconia. For those same 4 reports, the respondent practiced professional geology by showing activities that are found under reporting standards for geoscience and require a professional geologist. He also practiced professional soil science when he interpreted soil studies by producing soil maps at each of these 4 locations, which requires a professional soil scientist. He admitted that he did not work under a Minnesota licensed professional engineer, professional geologist, or professional soil scientist, and that his firm did not contract with a licensed professional to perform the work that he signed. The board issued a cease and desist order and assessed a $10,000 civil penalty. In another case, a professional engineer first licensed in 1984 let his license expire from July of 2016 through January of 2017. During the time his license was expired, he held himself out as a professional engineer and worked on 22 Minnesota projects. He signed and certified engineering documents with his PE license on 14 of those projects. The board reprimanded the licensee and assessed the civil penalty of $4,800. In a third case, a Minnesota licensed architect practiced professional engineering by preparing, signing, and certifying engineering plans for a utility infrastructure project located in Perham, Minnesota. Specifically, using his architect license, he signed and certified the title sheet under the heading of engineer, the pole evaluation sheet, the plumbing and riser diagram sheet, the excavation details sheet, the electrical sheet, the grounding details sheet, the pole embedment details sheet, the traffic control notes sheet, the vehicular traffic control plan sheet, and the general notes sheets. The licensee denied violating any provisions of Minnesota law, but agreed to the settlement agreement and cease and desist order, including a $5,000 civil penalty. Those are just a few examples of enforcement action that the board is taking against licensed and unlicensed individuals in order to ensure the protection of the public. This board has 21 volunteer board members appointed by the governor to four-year terms. Each member may serve up to two terms. We have three architects, five professional engineers, two land surveyors, two landscape architects, one professional geologist, one professional soil scientist, two certified interior designers, and five public members. The public members have the same participation and voting rights as any other member and offer a unique perspective as someone who is not a member of one of the licensed professions. The board and its committees meet approximately every other month, with the exception of the complaint committee, which meets more often. Members evaluate the credentials of applications for licensure certification to ensure that the education, exam, and experience requirements have been completed. They also conduct random continuing education audits, discuss national trends in licensure and enforcement, and review statutes and rules and propose changes as needed. Board members and staff provide educational outreach to citizens, legislators, building officials, fire marshals, and other state agencies, professional organizations, schools, and national councils about the value of licensure, the process of becoming licensed, continuing education requirements, the enforcement activities of the board, and how to file a complaint. Finally, the board is a voting member and active participant in each of the national councils representing the professions under the board. The national councils are organizations made up of member boards from each licensing jurisdiction, and board members from the states can serve on the council committees. Each council develops, administers, and scores the examinations used for licensure in the United States. The councils also facilitate professional mobility and promote uniformity of the U.S. licensure process, as well as lead the regulation of the various professions. During the last biennium, our board members spent over 5,200 hours on board activities. The board's staff include an executive director and assistant executive director, both of whom are shared 50% with the Board of Accountancy. In addition, the board has one investigator and four administrative specialists. During the last biennium, staff received and prepared for board review approximately 4,800 applications for examination and licensure, issued 2,400 new licenses or certificates, renewed 18,460 licenses and certificates for the next biennium, fulfilled nearly 4,000 verifications of examination results, license history, and disciplinary actions, gathered facts for 109 new complaints, received and prepared for the board review documentation for over 200 continuing education audits, and supported the board in all its initiatives. Like the Board of Accountancy, the board collects application, licensure, certificate, renewal, and late fees, which are set by the legislature to cover the board's direct and indirect costs. These fees, along with fines and civil penalties, are deposited into the general fund. The legislature appropriates funds to the board from the general fund for the board to conduct its business. The board received no pass-through funding or revenue from any other source, and at the end of the biennium, any unused funds are returned to the general fund. Expenditures include administration, information technology, enforcement, outreach and education, and credentialing activities. Staff salaries and benefits comprise 63% of this board's budget. The board's base level budget, again, has remained relatively flat over the years, while its revenue has steadily increased. In the last biennium, the board's revenue was nearly double the amount it was appropriated. We are asking for a budget increase of approximately $150,000 for the biennium to cover increased operating costs, additional enforcement activities, rulemaking, and IT projects. And we look forward to providing details about those expenses at a future meeting. The board is also working on several initiatives. The first would be streamlining the path to licensure. We have several rule changes that we are working on right now, including direct registration for examinations, decoupling, which means that the order in which you gain your education, examination, and experience doesn't matter. You still have to have all of the components in order to get a license, but you can do them in a different order. which can speed up the process to get a license, and then also providing broader education options for meeting the education requirements. We are also very close to launching our online applications for initial licensure. We've had it for renewals for many years, but the initial application process is more complicated and requires more documentation. So we're very close to launching that, which our licensees are very much looking forward to. Our second initiative is outreach. We do a lot of presentations to professional groups about the activities of the board and the importance of enforcement and discipline, or in how to file complaints. And then we also give presentations multiple times per year to university students on how to get a license, what the path to licensure is, and to guide them along in that process. Finally, the board is drafting some statute changes for the 2020 session. These changes will include retroactive enforcement, like the Board of Accountancy. After a license expires, the board no longer has jurisdiction, so we are, like the Board of Accountancy, looking for an additional 2 years to be able to take disciplinary action for things that occurred while the individual was licensed. And then we also are looking for classification of exam application data. The Minnesota Data Practices Act does not cover exam data because the board has a two-part process of taking exams and then taking another exam and getting licensed. So there's kind of a black hole that people are falling into on whether or not an exam applicant's information is private information. So we need to get that clarified. That concludes our presentation this morning.
Any questions? Representative Elkins.
Thank you. My usual question. So does this board have its own IT staff, or is the 9% of the budget mostly chargebacks from MNIT?
Ms. Fast or Ms. Barker.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, we get our services through Minute Services.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and testifiers. There seems to be a gap between what the engineering people are paying in their fees and the amount that's being spent in your office. Now, as I'm listening, it sounds as if the fees that they're paying or the revenue is going into the general fund, but then the legislature is appropriating the operating expense which support those people. I hate to ask you for an opinion because I don't want to put you on the spot, but it would seem to me then that the engineers are, to some extent, subsidizing the general fund here, because if the appropriation doesn't match the fees that they're paying, either we should bring the fees down that they're paying or raise the appropriation.
Ms. Barker.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, yes, the fees do all go back to the general fund, and the board has not been appropriated the same amount that it brings in. However, the general fund does fund projects that the licensees work on, such as roads and bridges and things like that, so it is related to their profession. But yes, the appropriation does not match the revenue that is brought in.
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up then. Since you also did the Board of the Accountancy before, would that be the same case there, mm-hmm. where there would be more fees being paid in by the profession than what is allocated to the good of the profession?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The board is not appropriate as much as it brings in. The Board of Accountancy is pursuing a statute change to eliminate a fee, which will bring that a little bit closer into alignment, and is also asking for additional appropriation to cover costs and do some more projects and enforcement that will benefit the licensees and the public.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Representative Vogel is noticing something, a pattern that I think many of us new people are observing, is that many of these boards and commissions, Secretary of State's office as well, actually are profit centers in some sense, and that the revenue that they receive from fees that are dictated by us actually are bringing in more revenue than they need to cover their own operating expenses. So it's, I think it's a good topic in general to discuss, because I suspect that as we have more of these presentations, we're going to see that pattern repeating itself a number of times. And would you like to comment on that yourself, Mr. Chair?
Well, Representative Elkins, I believe, and I may, and Ms. Roberts can correct me if I'm wrong, but there are some cases where they have funds set up, and I just had it in my brain, and it just, that the money goes into that fund, and then they get paid out of that fund. There are some people that, what is it, eat what you kill, I guess is the terminology is that you take, you spend the money that you bring in, is a term that they say. We put it in the, most cases we put it in the general fund and advocate it back, and then we try and set the fees in the legislature over time to make sure they match what the costs are. And then we'll see sometimes where they're not taking in as much as they're costing, and we adjust the fees, and sometimes we over-adjust. So it's a process that goes on in the legislature. And Ms. Roberts, if I'm wrong, or
Mr. Chair and members, you're correct. There are a variety of funding paths that they can take. Special, this is revenue. One. Many other boards are funded through what's called a special revenue fund, where their fees then go into that special revenue fund and are statutorily appropriated to them, so readily available to them. Mm-hmm. But there are a variety of different ways that they can be funded.
Representative Claiborne.
I just want to make sure that I heard the testifier correctly, if I may. I heard you say that in the Board of Accountancy, you're actually asking for a reduction in the fees because you feel that to be potentially onerous to the membership. Is that correct?
Ms. Barker.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the Board of Accountancy's statute change package is seeking an elimination of the $40 exam application fee because the board is no longer providing that service to its applicants. The National Council is actually processing the exam application. They take the exam and then they come to the board afterwards. And pay their license fee at that time. So that $40 application fee is a service that the board isn't providing, and so we are seeking to remove that because we shouldn't be charging a fee when we're providing no service.
Representative Claiborne.
Mr. Chair, and then the portion that goes to this committee, the Board of Architecture, you're not asking that those fees be reduced because the revenue that goes back into the general fund is actually used to the benefit of the profession with projects that they then perform for the state. Is that what I heard you say?
Ms. Barker.
Yes, thank you. Sorry. Thank you, okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. That is one thing that can benefit the licensees in addition to all of the services that we provide. But we are also asking for an additional appropriation in order to enhance our enforcement program, our outreach program, and provide additional IT work for the online applications and things like that. So we are neither board has really seen an increase in appropriation over the last 4 or 5 bienniums. Mm-hmm. And so we are seeking additional appropriations. We put in that request earlier on, and we realize that this is not the meeting that we're going to be discussing that, but by asking for the additional appropriation, that it brings it a little more in line with what we are bringing in for our revenue, and certainly will be beneficial to the licensees and the public.
And members, we'll have when the bills come for us, we'll have a lot deeper discussion into that part of it, but yeah. So Representative Claiborne, are you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure that I was truly understanding that money actually goes to additional employment and additional jobs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoyt, or Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. I just, so you are, there's continuing ed with all your programs is what I'm seeing. And I don't call myself a victim to continuing eds, but I have to do them myself, not for your boards. The question I have, does the state ever offer free CEUs to its members? I mean, some of these people work for nonprofits, you know, and so I'm just, I know you put the requirements in there to do the CEUs, but is there any help with that by the state, or when you put in new education requirements, do you offer any of these classes pro bono?
Ms. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The board itself doesn't offer continuing education, although when we do presentations to professional societies, then the members can get 1 hour of continuing education when we're talking about the activities of the board and regulation and things like that. But there are a plethora of opportunities for free or very cheap continuing education options out there. Lots of companies will offer in-house training, and there are, you can do self-study, you can do presentations. There's a variety of ways to get your continuing education that don't all involve sitting in a classroom and paying for a particular class or activity.
One more. Just follow up. So, yes or no, you do allow your companies to offer CEUs then if they're approved by you, I imagine. Is that right?
Ms. Parker.
Thank you. Yes, the board of Architecture and Engineering actually doesn't pre-approve courses and activities. But, yes, the companies can offer continuing education to their employees. The Board of Accountancy has a little bit more. The continuing education requirements for that board are a national standard, and so they have a whole NASBA registry where all the courses are listed. But again, they can do self-study, and companies often offer their continuing education to their licensees. So yes, they can do continuing education that is free.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question relates to the whole business of licensing trades and professions in Minnesota. We're looking at somewhere around 34% of all trades and occupations require a license now to go to work in the morning. And many trades provide pathways, such as carpentry or electricians or whatever, to be apprentices, to learn a trade or a skill, who are working under the direct supervision of somebody who is licensed. And my question relates to, I don't see in any of these professions that you've been presenting today that you have any pathways for individuals to be able to take the exam and become licensed without the traditional paths that you've set forth. I noticed that some of the occupations, or all of them, require a bachelor's degree, but not necessarily a degree in the profession itself. So is there a mechanism or a pathway where people working under the direct supervision of somebody who's licensed can eventually become licensed themselves and become an entrepreneur on their own? And if not, how come?
Ms. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. There are a variety of pathways to obtain a license, but they all do require education. Licensure is often looked at as a three-legged stool. You have to have the education component, the examination component, and the experience component in order to meet the minimum requirements for competencies. So there's things that you learn through education, there's things that you learn through experience, and then there's the examinations in order to meet those requirements and for the board to determine that people have met the minimum level of competency in order to protect the public.
And Representative Hertas, I know with the painters have it, I know the carpenters also have it in their apprenticeship programs, that by taking a few online, I guess if you say humanity courses, as they when they finish their apprenticeship, they actually get an associate arts degree. So they're on their way if they decide they wanted to go into another profession or move up in the
into some of these professions. So,
well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's a worthy discussion because we oftentimes are dealing with issues of income inequality, disparities, closed doors to minorities, being able to lift themselves up and out of poverty. And in my own career and in my lifetime, I would submit to all members that the level of licensing 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and 40 years ago is nowhere near the level then than it is today. And I think we've taken a step backwards in terms of providing opportunities rather than those who want to erect fences around their profession to allow pathways for people to learn a trade and a profession within it and to see their incomes grow.
Any further questions? If not, thank you for your presentation and thank you for being here. So.
Thank you for having us.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And next up will be the Board of Cosmetology, and you can see how we get the technology.
You can take the drive. Yep, yep. You can plug it into one of the five ports. If you want to just start, I'll get your presentation.
How was traffic for you this morning? Yeah, I was late myself.
You can start your presentation.
He wants me to start.
What's that?
He wants me to start. Would you like me to
Okay, yeah. Why don't you go ahead, Ms. Fast, and start. And please identify yourself for the tape. And there was not a handout in the packet, but hopefully when the presentation gets up, we can we'll see what her presentation was.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Chairman Nelson and members of the State Government Finance Division. I'm Gina Fast, the Executive Director for the Board of Cosmetology. I've been the Director for the Board since 2006, and the Board exists to protect the health safety of Minnesotans in their receipt of hair care, skin care, nail care, and eyelash care. The Board focuses on infection control, education, proper practice, and contributes to the continuous improvement of Minnesota's billion-dollar-plus cosmetology industry, thriving economy, and business growth while providing efficient and accountable services. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, employment of cosmetologists and hairstylists is projected to grow by 13% by 2026, faster than the average for all occupations. Thank you for the opportunity today to give you a brief overview of the Board of Cosmetology. I'll just try to multitask here, see how good I am. The board is statutorily here to protect the health and safety of the citizens of the state, all while encouraging industry development. In addition to the mission and visions you see here, the board is constantly reviewing statutes and rules to remove unnecessary barriers or obstacles that might limit entry to the profession, all while keeping the public protection at the forefront. Recently, the board eliminated the unnecessary restriction of a salon license being issued by type and distributed 5,000 new salon licenses under a single license type, therefore removing the burdensome requirement for an establishment to hold more than one license type. The Board of Cosmetology, by the numbers, we have just over 33,000 practitioners, over 5,200 salons, and 32 schools. Two of the schools are in prisons. One is a state prison and one is a federal prison. The board issues over 18 types of licenses and registrations related to services that involve hair, skin, and nails. To clarify, the board does not regulate body art or tattooing, which is under the Department of Health, or massage therapy. And to my knowledge, there's no state license that's county or city regulated, as we are often asked that. The board has been in existence since 1927. The board itself is comprised of 7 members. 6 members hold various cosmetology-related licenses, and 1 is a public member. And the membership terms are set out in statute. They serve four-year staggered terms and are all appointed by the governor. In the 2016-18 biennium, the board hosted 10 public full board meetings with one in Greater Minnesota. In addition, there were 19 board committee meetings. In total, board members are estimated to spend over 600 hours on board meeting and committee duties related to compliance, rules, licensing, legislation, and have reviewed thousands and thousands of pages of documentation related to complaints, rules, and board packets. We hold numerous advisory and task forces that both board members and licensees and stakeholders may sit on. All right, so some might feel this is what the Board of Cosmetology regulates and looking for while protecting the public. In reality, this is what we are looking for. We review infection control practices upon inspection, as you can see here in these photos, of a filthy wax pot where double dipping has occurred, and the disinfectant too low, not actually doing anything, to reuse buffers. And just look at that towel warmer, where that towel might be placed on your face next. We also see issues of improper waxing techniques and the use of illegal surgical implements. Lastly, we need to verify credentials, as cosmetology has fraud in multiple levels of education, and we see fake licenses on occasion. We are at the forefront of identifying this information. Next, I'll be giving you an overview of each of the divisions within the board staff. While each of the staff are housed in a division, services for the board spans all divisions, and staff routinely have work that cross multiple divisions. The licensing division is responsible for verifying credentials and ensuring each applicant has met prerequisite training, competence, insurance, and continuing education requirements to practice cosmetology or operate a salon or school. The division is responsible for assisting and servicing all licensees and applicants. Additionally, the division reviews and approves and audits continuing education curriculum and courses for practitioners. The division, with five staff, manages the issuance of 15 license types, two types of permits, and one registration type across five main areas: cosmetology, esthetology, nail technology, eyelash technology, and hair braiding. Specific education and testing requirements vary by type and can be attained in a number of ways, either through initial education in Minnesota, initial education outside of Minnesota, licensure in another state, or renewal. While multitasking with walk-in constituents, callers, and emails, dedicated licensing specialists issued on average 55 licenses per day and 3,540 licenses in the second quarter of 2018. The license population is currently at a total of 38,582, and as I said earlier, about 5,300 are being salons and 33,000 being practitioners. Between 2017 and 18, board have reviewed and approved over 155 unique continuing education courses related to cosmetology, business practices, health and safety, infection control, and other topics. These courses are offered to practitioners online and in person throughout Minnesota. The 109 providers of these courses are professional associations, schools, salons, and businesses of all size. Through the assistance by our staff and approval of their courses, the continuing education improves the safety and quality of cosmetology services in Minnesota. The licensing division is also responsible to audit continuing education. We audit just over right around 5% of all practitioner license renewals related to continuing education, and have found that about 11.9% of the audits have resulted in fraud or incomplete continuing education course completion. Upon discovery of a fraudulent or faulty submission, practitioners are required to fulfill their CE requirements and pay a penalty. Examinations. While the board itself does not directly administer examinations, it works closely with the development and administration of written examinations required for licensee. PSI, the board's contracted testing vendor, manages the exam process from evaluating psychometrically valid and subject matter expert reviewed items to operating exam locations throughout the nation and reporting passing scores to the board for licensed applicants. Licensure exams are offered in English, Vietnamese, and Spanish. Beginning in September, an enhanced feature was introduced where all foreign language exams have the option to have each question translated into English during their foreign language exam. the board, this has had a positive impact on both the schools and exam candidates. Exams can be taken several days a week at varying times and locations all throughout the state, including a few. I'll mention Edina, Duluth, Lake Elmo, Thief River, Rochester, Moorhead. Also, the board recognizes that applicants may seek Minnesota licensure from states all across the nation. And for that, to accommodate upcoming residents or practitioners of Minnesota, you can take the written exams in all 50 states. Next up, our inspection division and its 9 staff are responsible to inspect licensed salons and schools to ensure establishments are demonstrating proper infection control, proper licensure, as well as minimum standards. We take an education-first approach to inspection, utilizing them as teaching moments for salons, schools, practitioners, and instructors. Inspectors meet face-to-face with the board's licensees to identify any deficiencies in health and safety practices, answer questions, and educate on the spot. Further, they act as a resource for educational materials, providing up to 7 upon inspection. Inspectors do not have territories, and they're on the road about 50% of the year and must rotate establishments they inspect, meaning they can't inspect the same location in a row. There's a little caveat: if you're under review, you might get the same person for an investigation. But in general, you cannot inspect the same place twice in a row. In the past biennium, the inspection division grew from 3 field inspectors to 6 and 2 investigative inspectors. Since 2006, we've increased the number of inspections performed by over 133%. We've implemented the utilization of a language line to assist foreign language speakers upon inspection and reduce barriers, as well as the inspectors have hosted several webinars with schools to work and answer questions while students are studying their state laws and rules. As I said, the division, earlier, the division is responsible for inspecting the state's over 5,300 licensed salons and 33 schools, as well as unlicensed establishments that are not in compliance with state law. The board aims to visit each licensed salon at least every 18 months. We're a bit faster. We're on track to be lower than that, but that's the expectation at this point, is 18 months. The board will do multiple inspections on a salon for those that pose the greatest risk to public health and on a more frequent basis. Some recent technology advancements in the inspection division. We implemented a new software that transitioned inspections from being administered on-site through paper checklists to a mobile application. This greatly reduced the administrative time manually transferring data to the board's database, thus increasing time spent inspecting. Inspectors now can instantly upload photos, notes, and violations relating to inspection, and the data is automatically retained. Further inspection reports can be immediately emailed to the salon or who needs them, as can orders to comply. They can, and the orders to comply can be completed online by the salon. In the coming months, the board also plans to release an online inspection report lookup for the public and practitioners, as well as make the ability to pay for inspection penalties online. The division anticipates this change in technology will increase at least allow us to at least inspect 373 more inspections to do per year.
And can you get it wrapped up here, because we have another presentation and we need to be out of here on time today.
Okay, so basically we also have the compliance division. It's made up of 5 staff, and they are responsible for investigating all public filed complaints. I'll move on for that one. I'll go quick. We can come back. And we also have a policy division. They're responsible for analyzing and renovating statutes, rules, policies, and the goal of simplifying the processes and managing all of our rule dockets. We've had several rule dockets over the recent years. We've had a major rule overhaul, mobile salon rules, eyelash extension rules, advanced practice aesthetics, as well as we have the policy division has a school liaison officer. Basically, any law that's passed generally for the Board of Cosmetology will also have to have rules passed with it as well. Lastly, so we have our administrative division that's responsible for board operations, technology, strategic planning, and board meetings. We've done over 45 technology initiatives in this division in the past year and a half, as well as we undertook the new branding effort. This next slide, and I'll just quickly let you look at the graph instead of going through it, but basically out of the board's 26 AFSCME, MMA, and MAPE staff, we had an engagement session, and if you can compare, our engagement of our workers is about 95% in comparison to 51% of all workers. We have a good staff, and they like working for our board. our budget, the board receives a direct appropriation from the general fund to cover the expenses. We're just over $2.7 million this year, with 83% of our expenditures going to salaries and technology. The board is revenues is about $2.8 million. Interesting fact, the board is on a three-year license cycle, therefore we only collect one-third of our renewal fees per year. Basically, here's so next up is a couple of our notable initiatives. We are working, we actually started a community and licensee reference group where we had an initial meeting with 20 attendees in 2 hours, and the idea is just to cover anything related to the board, and basically anyone will be invited, whether you're the public or the licensee. We have a rule docket coming up that is looking to reduce barriers. In particular, we're looking at the removal of the high school diploma requirement, so that will go through rulemaking process for comment. As well as we have some technology and social media enhancements that we're planning on doing. And I whizzed through that. So I'm done.
Well, thank you. And I know Representative Elkins has asked the last two boards about your IT people. You get that through the SMART system, through the Department of Admin. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, we are actually part of the Administrative Services Unit with all the other health-related licensing boards, and so it those services come through ASU and or Minute. We are not a part of SMART.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question relates to policies and infection control. In my earlier life as a coronary care nurse, I worked in ICU, CCU, emergency room. And oftentimes the provider is a vector with regard to the spread of infectious diseases and control. As I've patronized a number of salons over the years, and I sit there waiting for my turn to get in the chair, I notice that there's no hand washing between clients. Is there a reason you don't require that? But I think that's an important aspect of your policy and infection control. I see when they drop a comb on the floor, you get a fresh comb. New fresh combs are used, maybe even some of the scissors. But is there any reason you don't employ in a time of disease and infection control, you don't have a hand-washing policy?
Ms. Fast.
Mr. Chair, the sinks are a very hot topic at the Board of Cosmetology. We require sinks because there is proof that the closer you are to a sink, the more you will hand wash. As the director, cannot make people wash their hands between services. We would hope it is a requirement that they do. One of the initiatives that we're working on is more public awareness. So the public may say, hey, you didn't wash your hands. Can you wash your hands before you get to me? As I was going to say, one of the things we believe is that empowering the public with the knowledge of what is expected during a service will help promote infection control at the salons. And that's one of our 2019 initiatives. So there are requirements to wash hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? If not, thank you for being concise and for being here at the committee. Next, we have the Board of Barber Examiners. Good morning and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Thora Fisco and I am the Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Board of Barber Examiners. So barbers and cosmetologists are regulated separately. Minnesota was the first state to regulate barbers, passing the first barber legislation in 1897. And across the country over the next 40 years or so, all 50 states and the District of Columbia followed suit, and currently all 50 states and the district do regulate barbering in some fashion. Minnesota Barber Board gets its authority from Minnesota Chapter 154, As a regulatory board, it is the mission of the barber examiners to promote public health and safety by ensuring that barbers are appropriately trained and demonstrate the skills necessary to conduct barber services in a safe manner while using appropriate safety, disinfection, and disease control methods. The board is compromised of 5 members, each appointed by the governor for a 4-year term. 4 of those members are barbers, and 1 is a public member. The current barber members of the board collectively represent 185 years of barbering here in Minnesota. 2 of the board's barber members are past presidents of the National Association of Barber Boards of America, and 1 is actually a member of the Barber Hall of Fame. So one of those barbers works around the corner here at the Capital Stylist Barbershop. Despite his many announcements of retirement, you'll still find him there. So, not to be outdone, the board's public member is a dedicated public health professional with 25 years of public health experience, and he has brought his passion for public health to barbering by spearheading a program that utilized barbershops as a place for public health screenings, bringing mobile health screening units to barbershops, and also getting blood pressure kiosks put within some barbershops and schools. The board meets 6 times per year, and additional meetings are scheduled if needed, and the board's standing complaint committee also meets 6 times per year. The board conducts 4 examinations per year of students for the public schools, and we also have 1 correctional school, and they provide 1 exam in the correctional setting each year. The exams consist of a 100-question multiple-choice and true-false written exam, which includes basic barbering technique, chemistry as applied to sanitation, disinfection, disease control, and chemical hair services such as coloring, straightening, waving, and the Minnesota statutes and rules pertaining to barbering. Barbers also complete a practical demonstration as part of their examination for fitness to barber, and during that demonstration, they show their ability to safely use the tools and implements of barbering while applying the sanitation, disinfection, and disease control procedures. My example here is, if you're a man and you're in a barber chair and a barber has a straight razor to your face, we would hope that they know how to use it and keep it clean. So, currently, there are about 3,000 barber registrations. So there are approximately 2,000 barbers, 800 barber shops, 145 student barbers. We have the 5 public schools and the 1 correctional school, and 20 barber instructors in the state. The board employs 3 full-time staff, 1 executive secretary responsible to managing board activities, staff, and functions that accomplish the board's goals and statutory mission of public protection, including management of the complaint and investigations and disciplinary actions as directed and delegated by the board and complaint committee. We have 1 administrative office specialist who's responsible for customer service. She greets all our customers, answers the phone, completes verification for credentialing, registrations, and the renewal process. And we have 1 law compliance officer or inspector who travels around the states and visits barbershops, inspecting and completing investigations. And he, like the cosmetologist inspectors, we try to educate and provide information to our barbers while he's out there on the road. The board receives a direct appropriation from the general fund for barber operations, and currently that base budget allocation is $343,000. My apology for the mistake on your summary sheet. And all board proceeds or revenues go back to the general fund. For the current fiscal year, the board estimates revenues of $295,000. And again, all of those revenues are deposited to the general fund. And currently, the board anticipates recovery of approximately 86% of its base allocation and 95% of its anticipated expenditures. So for the first time, the barber board is reaching a point where we're not bringing in the revenue from our fees to cover all of our expenses. It's close, but we're not quite there. And so we will be proposing some legislation to ask for some fee increases to help bridge that gap. More on that later. So
In the interest of your short timeline, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude and stand for questions.
Well, thank you. Representative Acom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Fisco, I was just wondering, it struck me, has there ever been an initiative to combine the Board of Barber Examiners with the Board of Cosmetologists? It just feels like there's some commonality there.
Some of us that have been here a while know the answer to this question.
But
Ms. Fisco.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it does predate my time with the board. However, in 2004, the two boards were combined, and in 2009, they were separated again. And he's not a member of this committee, but Representative Gunther, I'm sure, could tell you the entire story.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't mean to open a can of worms. Sorry about that. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Ms. Fisco, there's no truth to the rumor that Ken the Barber was on the original Barber Board in 1897?
Mr. Chair, no, I'm sorry, not quite that early.
Thank you for your testimony, and thanks for coming to the committee.
Thank you.
Members, any other questions, anything else we need to discuss? Otherwise, the meeting is adjourned.